Okay, the Lord be with you.
God
Also
is
with
with
you.
you. Yeah.
Let's pray. Good and gracious God, we give you thanks that you have gathered us into this place, into this space once more. We gather across our region, across the state of California. We gather sometimes in this time and moment, and sometimes later for those who catch up, and for the opportunity to join across time and space in this way. We give you thanks. Bind us together now. Open our hearts, our minds, our eyes, our souls to you. Open us to one another and open us to the ways that your word is moving within us and throughout the world. We pray all this, trusting in your presence here among us now. Amen.
Amen.
All right, everyone. We are in Luke, chapter 4 is technically where we are. That's really only because we, as y'all might remember, I guess I could do it again, but I read the lineage of Jesus, the ancestors of Jesus. I don't think I'm going to read that again. So we had a little bit of discussion, but that was really only the last couple of minutes of our time together. So I want to, just open up the possibility, if anybody has anything that they weren't really able to cover or say, or there was something on the tip of your tongue, but we had to wrap things up. I want to open up some space for that. But if not, we will just go straight into chapter 4. So anything kind of lingering, any lingering questions from what we've read until now? Okay, hearing none, let's move into chapter 4. So today, I this is the place where I anticipate that we will no longer be consuming a chapter at a time. These stories become a little less familiar, or maybe they're also familiar, but it's there's just so much richness. There has been, but there also is so much richness to come. So, but we're going to take it about a story or a section, or sometimes the word is pericope, one pericope at a time. That's just like a chunk of time, a lesson that holds together. So, who would like to read the section we're after here is chapter 4, verses 1 through 13. This is Jesus's temptation, 1 through 13. Chapter
All
four.
right.
Thanks. Thanks, Jane.
Jesus, full of the Holy Spirit, returned from Jordan and was led around by the Spirit in the wilderness for 40 days, being tempted by the devil. He ate nothing during those days, and when they had ended, he became hungry. And the devil said to him, "If you are the Son of God, tell this stone to become bread." And Jesus answered him, "It is written, man shall not live on bread alone." And he led him up and showed him all the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time. And the devil said to him, "I will give you all this domain and its glory, for it has been handed over to me, and I give it to whomever I wish. Therefore, if you worship before me, it shall all be yours." Jesus answered him, "It is written, you shall worship the Lord your God and serve him only." And he led him to Jerusalem and had him stand on the pinnacle of the temple and said to him, "If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down from here, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you to guard you, and on their hands they will bear you up, so that you will not strike your foot against that stone." And Jesus answered and said to him, "It is said, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test." When the devil had finished every temptation, he left him until an opportune time.
Thank you, Jenny. All right, words, phrases, images from the text, questions. Cheryl, go ahead. Take us away.
Verse 9. I don't know why I thought Jesus stayed in the desert for 40 days and he was tempted by the devil. in the desert, like on a high stone, to be picking off a stone rather than going to Jerusalem and standing on the highest point of the temple. To me, I'm going, oh my gosh, all these years, have I been just missing something?
Yeah, what do others make of that? How
Because
do
I thought he
you,
was,
yeah.
yeah.
I thought he spent 40 days in the wilderness.
That is also what it says. Yeah. So I mean, how do you all imagine this? I mean, that is an interesting little thing there.
The thing that bothered me the most, though, too, is he went straight from the baptism straight into the wilderness with nothing in between. That I found perplexing.
Yeah. So how do we make sense? I mean, so Mark and Matthew also are going to tell this story. The details are a little different in Mark and Matthew. Even the order of the temptations is a little different. So it's almost like the emphasis of the story is changed in those other gospels. And yeah, here in Luke we get this detail. It's almost like Jesus is sort of being well, so we know Jesus is the Son of God. That's not a secret. The heavens have announced that, three decades earlier. So now we have the devil taking sort of whisking Jesus around, right? It's almost like Jesus is born into time and space, but then when he's talking to the devil, it's almost like he can be sort of transported around really quickly. So, Cheryl, I'm with you. There is kind of this sort of, what is this, like a blink of an eye and boom, they're in Jerusalem, and blink of an eye, boom, they're on a mountain. Fascinating stuff. Mark and Matthew don't really tell the story that way, but Luke tells it that way. So, what do we make of that?
I wasn't really sure what to make of it. I thought, well, we're the 40 days over, and then he just zooms off to Jerusalem. And being, to the highest point on the temple, I was wondering about the significance of that too.
Yeah.
So I just that yeah, I thought he was just 40 days in the wilderness, and that was ended the temptation, then off he went. So
Yeah,
just
I have found a
eye-opening
question.
for me.
I have a question.
Go ahead, Nabil.
As we know that Jesus, he's the same time he's the God, how he is allowed for devil to tempt him. That mean maybe the sometime David he devil he's going to tempt us also.
Yeah, so this was kind of part of our conversation yesterday. As it happens, we're going to be reading the book of Job in church on Sunday mornings for about the next four weeks or so. We get a little bit of Job. And Job, so the word in Hebrew for Satan is actually, it's actually not capital S Satan. It's actually the Satan. Ha-Satanas is what it is, and in Hebrew, and that literally translates to the accuser. So if you remember, so we're going to hear this on Sunday, but I'll just kind of run it. Job begins with this scene between God and Satan, or the accuser. And God is saying, "Oh, Mr. Accuser, look at my wonderful creation, and especially notice Job. Oh, my most faithful servant in the world. Nothing on earth could make Job go astray." And the Satan says, "Well, I can think of a couple things." And God says, "Great, do it, Job, or do it to Job. Take away everything and just watch. Job is still going to praise me." And then we get 27 chapters of Job's agony and questioning, why? So in the sort of, I guess the word I'm going to use is the biblical imagination, this takes place in the heavenly court, this sort of mythical scene. And what is kind of both what disturbing or makes us as 21st century Christians, since we have a little bit of a different theology, the Satan, the accuser, seems to hold some kind of position in this heavenly court, with God seated on a throne. And so here, we could just as easily, okay, so here's how we get the word devil into Greek. When the Hebrew Bible was translated into Greek, for the Septuagint, the Old Testament, they used this word, diabolos, to translate the Satan, and that's how it comes into Greek, devil. So really, we're talking about this same figure, Hasatanas, the accuser, and the devil. It's all kind of one. So this accuser figure in Job and in here, notice the words that he starts the sentences with here. He says, "If you are the son of man," right? And another way of saying that is, who do you think you are, right? Or if it's really true that X, Y, and Z. And so this is almost like another way that sometimes scholars will talk about the accuser, when the accuser comes up like this, is like a house inspector. It's almost like Jesus is being inspected, or the prosecuting attorney. Now, I think the idea of the devil is a little bit more, certainly a little bit more complex than that. It's not just simply the accuser. For example, in verse 13, when the devil had finished every test, so again, kind of that home inspection, he departed him until an opportune time. That opportune time is going to come when Judas is tempted by the devil in chapter 22 and tempted to betray Jesus, right? So there is some malevolence here. It's not just simply a home inspection that's going on. But yes, Nabil, I mean, so I want to come back to your question, kind of like we talked about yesterday. Spiritual caregivers to this day, mine included and myself included, will talk about the ways in which language like this kind of seeps into our psyches, right? Now, whether this is the devil putting this idea in our mind or whether this is just being human, I'm not going to say for sure. But these questions of who do you think you are, these self-doubting questions, these questions that sometimes take the very essence of who we are, Jesus is the Son of God, call it into question, turn it into a bad thing, and then say, eh, you really can't be so certain about that. In other words, eroding our faith, eroding our trust in God, God whose promises, you are my child, my delight, I love you beyond anything you could ever imagine. The accuser has this way of kind of eroding that, right? I'll give you a personal example. Almost every time I preach a sermon, anywhere, anytime, I always hear a kind of accuser thought, which is, oh boy, who do you think you are doing? Yeah, you really stretched biblical imagination this time, Pastor. Almost always, really. It kind of strikes to the core of you. And sometimes I just have to say, shh, be quiet, you, be quiet, right? My guess is that most of us who have done anything from being a family member or a parent or a spouse or served in some kind of vocational role, know that kind of feeling of self-doubt, right? Know that feeling of sort of being allured or tested away from the core of who we are. So anyway, that's the accuser. That's who we're meeting today in here, in this text. The tradition of
Pastor,
people still live on. Yeah, go ahead,
you
Nabil.
don't think now these days the devil is tempted the some people on their conscience, because as we know that people going for gambling or for a drug, that mean the devil, they tempted him to go to there to for gambling or for a drug. That is the work of the devil doing now.
Well, I think different traditions are going to have a kind of different understanding of the devil and of sin. I mean, one of the ways that I understand sin is separation, right? Separation, missing the mark. These are kind of classic understandings. And so I don't know that I believe that every human misdeed is a temptation from an external force. I think actually sometimes those are internal to us. And maybe they all are. I don't know. So I'm not going to say yes or no. But I think what is dangerous to me, one of the reasons I'm careful about devil language, is because it becomes really easy to demonize someone whose actions seem strange, right? So, classic easy example is Salem witch trials, right? This group of women who are not whose way of living in life is not fully in accord with the religious understandings of their community. Maybe mental health is, maybe sexuality is a factor, maybe all these different things, and yet they are demonized. So I tend to be really careful with language of the devil because I know how easy it is for humans, especially religious humans like myself, to turn that language against the human being. But it can also be really helpful too. Boy, I'm curious. I want to get some other perspectives in here and see how this resonates. Go ahead, Sue, and yeah.
Okay, I'm going back to what Cheryl said. The way this reads, I'm almost thinking the temptations that are described here came after the 40 days, after the 40 days were complete. That I'm starting to read it that way. These were came after he had spent the 40 days when he was famished, and all this was after the time he spent in the wilderness.
Yeah, so we actually have, I was just reading about this. We have other Jewish stories from this time and earlier. One comes up in Ezra, for example, of these kind of events where a person or a prophet or a leader goes into the wilderness, fasts for a huge amount of time, and then experiences a vision, right? We know actually here in North America, the Crow, Native American tribe, now located in Montana, the Crow have a version of this as a kind of a coming of age ritual, right? Where a young man goes out and for 5 days does not eat or drink and then experiences and then needs to have a dream really as a kind of a coming of age moment. So I don't mean to downplay this story of Jesus's as in importance, but to say, yeah, there's something to the way I think that Luke is presenting the story where Jesus experiences this 40 days of hardship, and then he has kind of he has this vision, and the vision, however, so let's kind of take these things one by one. Dixie, I just want to say, hey, you came in the middle of a bunch of demon and devil talk, so welcome. But I want to take these kind of one by one, and what I want to say about these is that there is a real humanity, almost a universal humanity to each of these temptations, if we kind of boil them down and distill them. So okay, let's take it one by one, and I actually am going to invite you to sort of help us distill what is going on in this temptation. Okay, so Jesus ate nothing at all. So I'm here in verse 3. If you are the Son of God, again, that's the accuser talk, command this stone to become bread or a loaf of bread. So what is the core of that temptation? What's the core of that temptation? From the devil to Jesus. Anybody at all? Go ahead, Ginny. I see you're gearing up. I'll have you unmute. Oh, you're still muted. All right, well, Ginny is figuring that out.
I
Anybody
think,
else? Yeah, go ahead.
I think to show that the devil, Satan, he is a powerful in this case. Even he tempted Jesus in this case. For that reason, Jesus, he didn't give him any chance to become a power at this time.
Yeah, so there is kind of a tit for tat sort of power duking it out here. But I'm curious, like, so Jesus, or the devil says, look, if you're the Son of God, command the stone to become a loaf of bread. What's that temptation? What's at the core of that? Anybody at all? Go
End
ahead.
of fasting.
Oh, yeah, Sue, go ahead first.
Oh, okay. I was gonna say the end of fasting. There's no reason for you to fast.
The end of fasting?
Go ahead
Okay.
and eat. Go ahead and eat.
Go ahead and eat. Okay, Cheryl, go ahead.
Kind of related to that, I mean, the hunger issue. He's got to be hungry. I mean,
Yeah.
there's a humanness to Jesus, and he hasn't eaten for 40 days or 40 nights. There's the hunger issue. So
Yeah.
to me, that's
Yeah. If you've ever done any kind of fasting, either for religious or dietary purposes, yeah, it's going to be like you can make a logical choice out of anything. Dixie, I saw your hand. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just thinking it's more of a he's calling Jesus's bluff.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. Yeah. So an invitation.
Prove it, you know?
Yeah, prove it. Prove it. Okay, that's good. Jenny, go ahead. Sorry, Jennifer. Jennifer. Yeah, sorry, Jenny.
I'm going along with what Sue said about ending the fast, but kind of with a note. So Jesus was called by the Spirit. That's what comes out to me every time that I didn't see that for years. That Jesus was called. He followed that calling to go to the desert. So it is his, he's following the Spirit, and there are certain things we can learn, experience, etc., only by this kind of fasting. It's kind of isolation. And so yeah, he's tempted to end what he, you know, because it's easier, the easier path is usually, you know, it will end any learning, right? So to not experience that. So yeah, I agree with Sue, to end that fast, to use his power to just supply his own human needs and be done with it.
Okay. So, I'm gonna give you a couple more words because you're just sort of, but the devil is saying, hey, there's a quick fix here, right? There's a quick and easy fix. You've been fasting for a long time. How about a quick and easy fix? And you know, there is something kind of maybe I'm over universalizing here, but in the midst of our daily lives, we encounter complex challenges. One of them being world hunger, right? Humanity. I mean, not only my hunger, but the need of feeding every single person in the world. And the devil here is saying, oh, this is easy. I'll just give you a quick fix. Anybody who has done any kind of work, whether feeding someone or helping someone, knows that the world is anything but quick and easy, right? These require complex, just feeding somebody requires a complex, sophisticated mechanism of distribution and finance. And I mean, today our global economy is even more complex. But even in Jesus' day, simply being fed is not a matter of me and my hunger. I have to talk to a farmer and get my wheat. The farmer has had to put in months of toil to get that wheat and then to find a mill for it. And then somebody had to bake it, right? And the devil is saying, short circuit it all. Easy answers are all we need to big problems, right? So that's one of the ways that sometimes this is kind of looked at is like, okay, in the immediate, there's this end. Fill your hunger, fill your belly. But really, the devil is tempting something kind of a little bit bigger and kind of a challenge that I think every community faces, calls for quick fixes that in the immediate feel really good, but in the long term just won't do the trick. So that's the first one. Let's go on to the second one. The devil, verse 5, the devil led him up and showed him in an instant all the kingdoms of the world. And the devil said to him, okay, so where is up? I'm not sure where up is. But anyway, the devil showed him all the kingdoms of the world. Devil said to him, to you I will give their glory and all this authority, for it has been given over to me, and I give it to anyone I please. Oh boy. Okay. Just a couple of questions. How does the devil have all the authority of the world to give to Jesus? Right? There's a couple of different ways we could answer that. One, we've already heard about the kingdoms of the world. We've heard about Emperor Augustus and Tiberius. They're supposed to be the most powerful leaders in the known world. Is the devil their real leader? Is the devil the real one who into whose hands authority rests? Of Herod. So this temptation is to earthly power, but it kind of calls things into question, like who's really the power behind the power? That's one of the things. Okay, if we could distill that temptation into a kind of an earthly, everyday temptation, like I just did with the first, what do you think? What is it? Yeah, Jennifer.
Well, I kind of think it's about actually when the devil says it. It's the first time I really heard that, for it is mine to give. I felt like that is what happens when we're only operating out of our own human egocentric perspective, that if we only think about even like our own needs, period, our own power, and just forget everybody else, that maybe that is diabolical. So that kind of power is like j only leaning on human power is basically what the temptation, I think, is. Like, hey, you could, I could do all of this. There's all, if I don't give a dang about anybody else, the whole dang world could be mine, you know? Because look what all these conquerors and violent people and evil rulers have done. So that's what I think that temptation is.
Yeah, well said. Anyone else kind of want to add to that or jump in? Jenny, I think you've really given us a pretty round picture there, right? It's this temptation to like all the authority, all the glory that supposedly Caesar has it. Now Jesus is going to have it. It's a different kind of authority and different power than Jesus is going to seek or wield by going to the cross. It may even be the opposite kind of power and authority. So not only is he saying no thank you to that, but is also kind of a warning for his followers. Like maybe Jesus's followers also should be worried about seeking that kind of power for ourselves. I think I really appreciate it. You took it to ego and sort of self-fulfillment. Yeah, absolutely. There's a piece of that there too. Okay, third temptation. Oh, by the way, that one was contingent on worshiping the devil. Okay. Number nine. This is the interesting. We talked about Jesus sort of being whisked away to Jerusalem. Verse 9. The devil took him to Jerusalem and placed him on the pinnacle of the temple, saying to him, "If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down from here, for it is written, yada yada yada." Throw yourself down here, and the angels will pick you up. So, who can distill that one for us?
think he was just tempting Jesus.
Is there, Dixie, is there anything in that is there anything in that temptation that you resonate with or anybody? How do I ask that question?
Well, I think if somebody said that to me, I'd kind of want to say, okay, I'll do it. Go ahead. I don't know.
Yeah, Sue, go ahead.
I'm just thinking it takes me to the cross
How so?
with Jesus. My God, my God, why have you forsaken me? And then saying to him, if you are the Son of God, save yourself. And it almost sounds like the same type of situation.
Exactly. It, in other words, it turns God into a kind of magic trick, a purveyor of magic tricks, right? It actually it diminishes the power of God into a sort of like, again, a display of power, a display of self-importance, kind of a trickery. Whereas I think when we hear Jesus say that on the cross, we are, we as listeners, we're aware of the magnitude of what is being accomplished and also the humanity of saying, save me, right? And we're kind of meant to sort of struggle with that, but God is not a God of cheap tricks, in other words, right? And don't tempt God into cheap trickery, right? Don't reduce God's role into the world or in the world as so small as just these kind of finite little cheap things, right? That sort of makes us out to be pretty self-important. Maybe back to Jennifer's point about ego and self-importance. So anyway, so I go into that because these temptations feel a little abstract and kind of out there, but in the same way that we've just heard that Jesus, through Joseph and David and Abraham and then Enoch and Adam, is Son of God through all these other human beings, we now have learned that Jesus and his followers are going to be tempted. In this, in the, or Jesus is tempted in the same way that we're tempted, right? Jesus faces the same struggles, the same grandiosity that says, oh boy, if you were just the biggest and the greatest person in the world, wouldn't that be wonderful? If you only you had $10,000 more a year, think of what you could do in this world. If only you were in charge, wouldn't that world just be better? So Jesus, in another way of putting it, Jesus is just like us. I don't know if you all struggle with those kind of accusations or questions, but I know I do. Temptations in those directions. What else?
Pastor,
Yeah, go ahead, Nabil.
the third temptation was in Jerusalem.
That's what
And
Gerald was noticing. Go
that
ahead.
mean at that time, Jerusalem, they are very sinner. For that reason, devil, he ruling Jerusalem at that time, and he in that time he want to show the Jesus that is Jerusalem, it belong to me.
So you're kind of saying that almost reminds us back of the second temptation, right? Of all the kingdoms of the earth are mine. So what I hear you saying is, this belongs to me too. That's one of those interpretations of what's going on here that Christians have put forth, and we'll see, kind of some evidence for that. Not necessarily that this is the way I interpret it, but some evidence for that is the people who are in Jerusalem, the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders, are the ones who are going to be putting Jesus to death, right? So the implication here is, do they all work for Satan? Are they all agents of Satan? We're going to see a thread of that going through Luke's gospel. And not unlike Mark, if you've been a part of our Wednesday morning or Tuesday morning Bible study, Mark has some of this really cosmic imagery of kind of a battle between Jesus and Satan. Luke picks that up too. It's not as strong in Luke's gospel, but yeah, I think that that's a possibility here too.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Nabil. Okay. So just a couple other things. Oh boy, it's 4:40. We're never going to make it through Luke. Just a couple of other things here too. There are some resonances with the story of the Hebrew Bible, I mean, over and over again. So how long are the people tempted in the wilderness after leaving slavery? 40 years. How long? Oh gosh. There are all this number 40, 40 days, 40 years. The fact that he's in the wilderness, wilderness and exile and liberation, these are all sort of terms, and it's all sort of the same substance of the Old Testament, and the New Testament kind of has these same things going on. So keep note of that. Well, that's, I guess, oh, I think we'll leave it right there. We've got another really wonderful story, and I'd like to get this, but we're gonna cut it up into two sections. I'm gonna read this first little bit, but do I have a reader? Well, actually, no. Verses 14 through 21. 14 through 21. Who'd like to take that on? Okay, Jennifer, and then 22 through 30. 22 through 30. We're just going to read it, right? So 14 to 21 is Jennifer. 22 to 30. Who'd like to take that? Dixie, will you do that? Okay, thank you. Take it away, Jennifer.
And now Jesus returned to Galilee in the power of the Spirit, and news of him spread through all the surrounding district. He taught in their synagogues to everyone's great admiration. Then he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and according to his custom, went to the synagogue on the Sabbath day. He stood up to read the scriptures, and the book of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him. He opened the book and found the place where these words were written. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he anointed me to preach good tidings to the poor. He hath sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty them that are bruised, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. Then he shut the book, handed it back to the attendant, and resumed his seat. Every eye in the synagogue was fixed upon him, and he began to tell them, "This very day this scripture has been fulfilled while you have been listening to it."
All who spoke well of him and were amazed at the gracious words that came from his lips. "Isn't this Joseph's son?" they asked. Jesus said to them, "Surely you will quote this proverb to me, 'Physician, heal thyself.' And you will tell me, 'Do here in your hometown what we have heard that you did in Capernaum.' Truly I tell you," he continued, "no prophet is accepted in his hometown. I assure you that there were many widows in Israel in Elijah's time, when the sky was shut for 3.5 years, and there was a severe famine throughout the land. Yet Elijah was not sent to any of them, but to a widow in Zarephath, in the region of Sidon. And there were many in Israel with leprosy in the time of Elisha the prophet, yet not one of them was cleansed, only Naaman the Syrian." All the people in the synagogue were furious when they heard this. They got up, drove him out of town, and took him to the brow of the hill on which the town was built, in order to throw him off the cliff. But he walked right through the crowd and went on his way.
Thank you, Jennifer, and thank you, Dixie. So, words, images, phrases, what do y'all see in this? Where do we start?
I've always found that that first proclamation just very, very powerful. Just I can just imagine it. And I also think of, let those who have ears hear when he's saying that, and then how hard it is to hear someone you think you know already. But really, that is the quintessential Jesus for me, to just proclaim good news to the poor, I recall that you mentioned that the book of Luke, the Gospel of Luke, has particular slant towards the poor and marginalized, and the poor in many ways, the excluded, etc. And so here, this his first recorded public words in the synagogue in the Gospel of Luke are these right here. I think that's really powerful.
And in Luke's gospel, Luke uses this word more than any other gospel writer. I think all the others combined for the particular form of the poor is the potuksoi. The potuksoi are the destitute, the beggars, those whom the world spits upon, right? Potuksoi. And here Jesus says, "This is my mission, right? The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because He's anointed me." To bring good news to the poor. It's like, wow, it's like Jesus is sort of writing his own job description in a way, right? But he's reaching back to Isaiah for it. And yeah, Luke, this is a story that is unique to Luke, at least the way that this story comes through. Jesus will quote other things like this in other gospels, but this him just plopping himself down, opening the scroll, and boom. This is unique to Luke. Thanks,
You
Jenny.
think that's what the people in the church, the elders, wanted him to read, that section right there?
That's a great question. So there's some debate about this. And I'll give you the 2-minute answer. It's so kind of like we have a lectionary where, right? I have assigned readings for the next 3 years, and then we just go round and round. There's evidence that actually Jewish communities who gathered in synagogues actually had something like that in Jesus's time. So there's some debate. Was he just handed the lectionary reading for that day, and it was like, oh yeah, here I am, and by the way, this is who I am. Or it almost kind of is presented that way, right? The scroll of Isaiah is handed to him. He opens it. Or did Jesus wander in one day, say, "Hey, yeah, I'll be the teacher," and then ask for Isaiah and open it up? We don't really know. It's kind of open to interpretation. But yeah, there's some hint here, and actually we have historical evidence that indeed they did have assigned readings for the day. Now, if that's the case, though, there's a couple of problems. One is that Jesus actually, at least the way that Luke tells the story, Jesus leaves a little bit of Isaiah out. He kind of skips around and summarizes. So if we were to go to the chapter of Isaiah where this is being read from, let's assume he's reading from the Greek version of it. Even the Greek version of it really does not line up with this. So, and then my Jewish scholar says, and you better believe in a synagogue, if you read something wrong, it's not like a Christian church. If somebody mumbles their words, other people will shout, "You're reading that wrong," and they'll correct you. She says, that's a time-honored tradition in synagogues. Whereas I can't imagine somebody doing that on Sunday morning here. So that's a great question, Dixie. Did Jesus select this himself? Was it given to him was it sort of divine providence that he read that day? Well, who knows? That's a great question. What else? What else do we see here? Other questions that come up?
I don't really understand the points that he's trying to make in verses 25 through 27.
What
I don't know what that means.
Yeah. What do you all think about that? Great question, Janine. Kathy, you're kind of shaking your head. Do you have anything?
No, I was equally as confused. I don't understand the.
Yeah.
So, yeah, enlighten us.
Anybody else have any ideas? Well, so it is kind of vexing. And in some ways, he's kind of picking a fight here. They were impressed with him. They're like, so he pronounces, he's maybe misquoted Isaiah, and they're like, wow, Joseph's son, look who this kid's grown up to be, right? And then he turns around and Jesus kind of picks a fight, right? Because right before that, it says, they all spoke well of him. They're amazed at the gracious words coming from his mouth. And then he says, doubtless you're going to say to me, do here also in your hometown the things we've heard you did at Capernaum. They're kind of like, we didn't say that, but okay, sure, yeah, maybe we would say these things. But okay, so now to this thing in 25. So in 1 Kings, the prophet Elijah prophesies 3 years of drought because of the bad actions of Ahab and Jezebel, king and queen in Israel. So, in that story, that 3 years of drought and famine is a punishment for their evil ways. And Elijah is starving. And you would think, well, if Elijah's starving, somebody in Israel is going to feed him. Somebody, one of our own, is going to come to the rescue. And then God sends Elijah outside of Israel to be fed miraculously by the woman in Zarephath and her son. So here we have this story of outsiders kind of coming to the rescue of Elijah. And then again, Naaman the Syrian, Elijah's, I don't know why he had to be named Elisha, but Elisha heals Naaman. Naaman is a commander of the Syrian army. He's a Gentile, and God does miraculous, wonderful works of salvation in Naaman's life. So, in a way, we are hearing Jesus not only picks a fight, but then he's saying, this good news that I have, it's for not y'all, it's going to be for people who are outside. It's going to be for the Gentiles. Just like good things happened to the widow of Zarephath, who's a Gentile, and Naaman, who's a Gentile, this good news is going to be not just for you, but for the Gentiles. No wonder they throw him off a cliff, right? Like they've just given him rave reviews. And then he goes and picks a fight with them. How do we, like, this is actually kind of vexing to me and to other interpreters, because it seems like Jesus is kind of intentionally provoking the crowd. How do we reconcile this? Or does anybody have any, well, maybe we read it this way and helps us out? Yeah, Jennifer, go ahead.
I was thinking it'd be kind of like a church that says, yeah, we're a Christian church. We're a welcoming church. And then guess what? We find out that they don't welcome gay people. And then a pastor comes in, like, oh, this great pastor, he's so well spoken, and she's really got a lot of great social outreach ideas and everything. Oh, but she wants us to welcome everybody. And you're like, hey, everybody, I'm here. And guess what? I've got news for you. This is not going to be quid pro quo here. It's not going to be fulfilling your traditions as you see them fit. I'm actually going to fulfill them as I feel God has called me to do. That's how I kind of think of it. Because the Jewish, look what happens. Look what they do to Jesus. So he was kind of ahead of his time in a sense. And maybe he was just like, just don't get any illusions here. I'm not here to build up what we've got going on. I'm here to disrupt it and make it welcoming to all people. So, because
Yeah.
yeah, as God's chosen people, like that's something that they held fast and dear to them. And he's gonna disrupt things, you
Yeah.
know.
Yeah. Sue, I saw your head kind of bopping there. I wondered if you had something to offer. Thanks, Jennifer.
I was just saying, his message is for all. Is what that's what I was agreeing. You know, it was not just for the Jewish in the synagogue, it was for all.
Yeah, and it reminds me, Jennifer, as you were just saying that, it reminds me of the struggle, say, of Dr. King, right? Where a lot of people are saying, yeah, this equality stuff sounds really good, but give it t just give it time, right? Just give it time. I know Jim Crow is terrible, but let's just let these white Southerners figure this out over time. And Dr. King is saying, you know, the more time we give people, it's just going to continue hurting, right? That's the letter from Birmingham jail is, we've had enough time. The time is now to disrupt this. And I think you're putting your finger on this dynamic of what feels like good news, what feels like the right thing to do. Yeah, absolutely. Can be so disruptive once we dial down into the details of it, right? It kind of reminds me of that first temptation of Jesus, right? Turn the Dixie, you're nodding. Turn the bread or turn the rocks into bread. And Jesus says, no, I'm not going to cut corners here. It's more complex than that. In a way, he's being tempted. There's kind of a temptation into, oh, this program sounds great. Yeah, release to the captives. Oh, done. Yeah, we're with you. And then we start dialing down into the details and we realize, wait a second, I'm the one who owns those slaves. Wait a second. I don't want good news to the poor. I'm not poor. Do I get the good news too? Yeah, Jen, I think you've put your finger on it. And Sue, yeah, good news for all. Begs the
Pastor,
question. Yeah, go ahead, Nabil.
yeah, what the reason for the Jesus, he didn't ask, teach the disciples about the temptation of the devil to him. Why he didn't teach them that maybe sometime the devil he is going to tempt the disciples?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, one way to respond is maybe he did, or else we wouldn't have this account of the temptation, right? How would we, in other words, how would we know the story of his temptation if he hadn't told them? So we don't have an episode of him saying, "Hey, this happened to me one time," but we do have the account of it. So if it was kind of one to one, he and the devil, nobody else witnessed it. He must have shared that account. Do you understand my logic
Yeah,
there?
okay,
Yeah,
thank you.
yeah, yeah, yeah. Go ahead, Sue.
Okay, I was just thinking of something. I was thinking of the word outcast and those on the margin, and how this is Jesus is the way. And that, and I'm that's what I'm picturing here. It's for all, basically, to be going back to that, but it's
Yeah.
as much they need, the outcasts need to hear the story as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we need to accept the fact that
Yeah. It reminds me that we are going to hear, I mean, Luke's gospel is the gospel of Jesus. He'll be accused of being a drunkard and a glutton. And that's really true in Luke's gospel. He is always going somewhere to go eat or coming from a feast. And it's interesting, he's usually eating with prostitutes and tax collectors and sinners, right? Mixed in with Pharisees and disciples too. And it's almost like he's saying, this is the hard work of good news to the poor, is accompanying people, breaking bread with people, not just good news isn't just here, have bread, your stomach's filled. Again, to that first temptation, good news maybe is more complex than just a kind of a one-dimensional, here, take the bread, eat it, now we're all done, transaction complete, right? Good news is bigger than that. Well, everybody, it's finally happened. We have not completed a chapter, and I'm just fine with that. I hope you are okay with that as well. We're going to pick it up here at verse 31, and thank you again for a wonderful day of conversation. We're going to say goodbye to our friends who are with us online. Goodbye. And we're going to have a prayer as we go into the night.